Okay. I think my friend, who I told you the story about Silas Marner, so I think he's actually going to come either Zoom in one day, or actually, if I can get Brandeis to pay for it, he'll come up and do a class. So you'll like it. Okay, so what I have, his name is Jeff Minigawa. What I have, thank you, distributed is, one is the poem The Lotus Eaters by Tennyson, which is not in, in the Ricks anthology, but you should read that for Wednesday as well. And the other is something that we'll talk about today. So just as a quick question, Tennyson is a poet who used to be done in middle school because he would say things that sounded profound, like his most famous profound middle school poem. Did any of you do him in middle school or high school? Do you remember what poem? I guess Cam dropped the class. That's what I'm getting. Okay. The famous poem that he did is Flower in the Cranny Wall. So that doesn't ring a bell. It's, well, let me recite it for you. Flower in the cranny wall, I pluck you out of the crannies as I stand with you in my hand, root and all. I reflect, I'm not getting this exactly right, but it's close enough. That if I were to understand you, root and all, I should understand what God and man is. And back in my high school years, at any rate, we were reading, I was reading, all my friends were reading books on Zen Buddhism, and T.D. Suzuki was saying, see, this is just so Western, look at Tennyson, he thinks it's okay to pluck the flower out of the wall. So it felt like, you know, to some people it felt like a vaguely Buddhist sentiment that this little flower in the cranny wall would stand for everything. But there was also the destructiveness of it. But anyhow, you know, there are famous poems by Tennyson that are a cut above Hallmark, but that get assigned in middle or high school because of the Hallmarkiness of them. And that is as wrong as you can possibly be about Tennyson. And I hope that some of the poetry that you read for today will give you the sense of that wrongness. Something like St. Simeon Stylites, which is weird as all get out, but maybe also something like Ulysses. The thing about Tennyson is that as pure, the pure skill of his poetry and the different kinds of poetry that he wrote are probably, he's the most skillful poet in English of the last 300 years. By no means the greatest, but up there, but the most skillful. And he experimented with all sorts of different styles, which we'll have some ability to get to talk about, but not that much. He's probably also, and this is maybe more surprising, the weirdest poet that we'll read. And he really is weird. So do people know who Benjamin Jowett is? Is that a name that rings a bell to anyone? Philosophy majors? Platonists? Okay, so it used to be that the standard English translation of Plato was done by a scholar named Benjamin Jowett, of whom the following ditty, a Victorian ditty, so it's okay for me to recite it for you, was written. It's, my name is Benjamin Jowett. I'm the master of Balliol College. If it's knowledge, then I know it. If I don't know it, it isn't knowledge. So he was like the one of those last people who knew everything, and he translated Plato, and he was a major professor of philosophy, and you know, master of Balliol College is like as good as it gets in academe, still probably. It's part of Oxford. Anyhow, he was, and the fact that they made fun of him that way indicates that he was also a little bit stuck up, because he knew everything. So he was a friend of Tennyson's, and he compared Tennyson to Socrates, which may seem like a weird comparison, but he said they were very similar in the following way, which is they could talk to anyone about anything, and they could interact with people on whatever level anyone wanted to interact with them. But they were strange as all get out. So what you had was a really strange, way beyond Six Sigmas out from an average human being with the weirdest thoughts, the weirdest attitudes, the weirdest perspective on the world. But their weirdness didn't prevent them from making themselves available to everyone in ways that everyone really liked, in ways that people could just talk to them about whatever they wanted to talk about. So that's a thing to think about Tennyson, because the sort of middle school, high school Tennyson is, yeah, we can make him work for middle schoolers. But the problem with that is the absolute sheer weirdness of Tennyson is something that you lose. And so one of the things that should be happening as you read through Tennyson is you should be attentive to just how strange this poetry is. And it may seem strange to you. Lots of older poetry that you don't know will seem strange to you because you just don't know it, and it's older, and it's not like what people are doing now. But Tennyson was regarded, his poetry was regarded as utterly strange at the time. His first two books of poems got terrible reviews because people just didn't know what to do with them. And what they felt, and you may have felt this also, is there's this all this description with strange repetitions in them, and where is it going? And there's a kind of obsessiveness to the style, obsessiveness, if not to Tennyson himself, although there's going to be a lot of obsessiveness in Tennyson himself, obsessiveness in his characters. So if you think of the Simon Stylites poem, which we won't have that much time to go through, but still, it's important to have read it and to have a sense of it for the class. Well, what did people think of that poem? Let me just ask you. There's actually, I think it's a Buñuel movie based on the same historical person. It's called Simon of the Desert. I think it's Buñuel, now I'm forgetting. But what did you think of that? Yeah, Quinn.
I mean, as with a lot of these poems, it makes a lot more sense when you actually Google the person.
Yes. So what did you find?
I actually kind of appreciated it, understanding the point of view a lot better. I kind of thought direct address to God is kind of fun to read for me, and the knowledge that it was also about his friend, and trying to get used to the Victorian obsession with death. That was mostly what I thought about.
Yeah, okay, so say more about who that friend is.
Tennyson had a good friend who died, and what I took away from the poem was not just the obsession with death, but trying to come to terms with not just like what happens after death, but whether what your life was made of was good enough.
Yeah, and whether anything happens.
Yeah,
so his friend's name was Arthur Hallam. He died, he was 2 years younger than Tennyson, and he died of a cerebral hemorrhage just out of nowhere. He was lying on a couch and he died at age 22. And Tennyson was in love with him. One of the things to know about Tennyson that he may or may not have quite known about himself was that his erotic life was same-sex. His erotic feelings and desires were same-sex. Not that he didn't have a heterosexual family life, but the person that he was obsessed with was Hallam, and he can be frank about his obsession, partly because he may not quite know how frank he's being. He may not be quite spelling it out for himself. But in Memoriam, which is what you'll be reading for Wednesday, he talks about his widowed race. He sees himself. He says, before my widowed race is run, he sees himself as having been widowed by the death of Power. One of the poems you read today is a Knights of the Round Table poem. Remember what it's called? Letter?
Workshop drawer?
Yeah.
However you say it.
Yeah. Ruther. No. Yeah, Mort d'Arthur, the death of Arthur, and that Arthur is also hell. If King Arthur's name had been King Bob, he might not have written that poem. But here is a poem about the death of Arthur, and it's a poem which might or might not suggest some possibility of an afterlife, but one thing to be thinking about when you read Tennyson is to wonder whether he is a believer in the afterlife, whether he's a believer in Christianity, whether he is using Christian stories, Christian beliefs, and so on for their usefulness, for the things that he's exploring. But as I mentioned last time, he's writing one of the things that you will see in In Memoriam AHH, In Memoriam for Arthur Henry Hallam, one of the things that you'll see in that poem is the line, nature red in tooth and claw. And what's happening, even though he wrote that line before the publication of Origin of Species, it was immediately connected when Origin of Species was published, I think 6 years later. It's immediately connected as the same idea as what Tennyson is doing. And Tennyson, as I mentioned before, the poems that we're reading are poems that he wrote under the influence of reading Lyell's great book. So here's just a little bit of intellectual history. A revolutionary book that Tennyson read in the early 1830s was Lyell, Lyell's book on geology. And what Lyell had figured out was that rocks and stones had been around a really long time, that canyons and mountains and other geological formations had taken hundreds of millennia or more to develop, that we lived in a world where everything that we're seeing, we're not living in a young world created 4,000 BC or so, which is what the Christian religion was arguing, and kind of what Judaism thinks also, or thought, what are we now, 5783 in the Hebrew calendar, which is roughly since the creation of the world, so about 6,000 years ago. But no, it wasn't 6,000, it wasn't 60,000, it wasn't 60 million years ago, it was longer than that. And that makes possible a theory of evolution. And the theory of evolution is not Darwinian. Darwin has a mechanism for evolution. Did people know this, that the idea of evolution goes back to the end of the 18th century? And the standard idea of evolution was that it was acquired traits could be passed on. So the reason giraffes have long necks is they stretched and stretched, and then their offspring, because their parents were stretching their necks so much, their offspring were born with stretched necks. And they stretch their necks some more, and they were born with stretched necks. So that is essentially false. If you're taking Morris's class and you want to say, well, it's not entirely false, and you should take Morris's class if you want a good science class, I sat in on it 3 years ago, and it's fantastic. But so if you want to say that's not entirely false, you're not entirely wrong, but it's 99% false. And it was Darwin who came up with the idea of natural and then sexual selection. But evolution goes back and is something that people were discussing since the beginning of the 19th century. But for evolution to work, you need a ton of time, and you need to look at a fossil record which suggests that there is, that most of the history of the Earth is a history in which humans had played no part in it. This is not a planet for us, as we are discovering yet again, as we make it a planet that is going to be uninhabitable. But it was not created for us. It doesn't exist because of us. It is not designed to support us. And this is the kind of shocking knowledge that people are facing up to in the first third, let's say, of the 19th century. And it's one of the things that Tennyson is thinking about and facing up to when his closest friend, the person he loved most in the world for his entire life, the person he loved most in the world, dies. And he can't take comfort in the idea that, okay, Hallam is in a better place now. Tennyson has as a motto to one of his books of poetry, I just want to get it exactly right, the words astronomy and geology, : terrible muses. So his muses are astronomy and geology. And they're terrible, not as in not skillful. They're terrible as in terrifying. Muses of terror. Astronomy and geology, they instill one with terror. And what they do is they make death all the more awful because you can't rely on religious faith. And so Tennyson has to, as every mourner does, Tennyson has to work out some other reconciliation, partial reconciliation, with the fact of the death of those he loves. Sometimes that can be fantasy, but it's not so much a fantasy that you would believe in, but a fantasy that would allow for the very beauty of the fantasy to be something that the death has made possible. Wallace Stevens in the 20th century has the famous line, death is the mother of beauty. And there is, it's not an inappropriate line for Tennyson. One of the things that you read today were a couple of songs from his long narrative poem called The Princess. And The Princess is worth reading. Graduate students. The long narrative poem is about, it's a first person narrative about a person who is involved in a kind of medieval romance, but is struck with a sort of deja vu-like mental experience that will come on upon him from time to time, in which everything will seem like it's a dream world. And it's that dreaminess, Tennyson is really interested in that dreaminess. One reason I want us to read The Lotus Eaters. People know who the Lotus Eaters are in the Odyssey. Who are they?
So
yeah.
You lose your mind.
Yeah, and it makes you feel how? Yeah, it just it makes you feel good. And you lose a sense of time, and you lose a sense of urgency, and all you can do is be in Lotus Land. And it's four lines in the Odyssey that Tennyson turns into a very long poem just about the attractions, essentially, of being high all the time. Not high as in giddy and excited, but high as in completely at ease and just floating in the moment. So that's what that poem is about. And in a lot of ways, the atmosphere of that poem is like the atmosphere of The Princess. Like the atmosphere maybe at the end of the Morte d'Arthur, where Arthur is going down the stream of this ship, not knowing where he's going. So there is a kind of, in Tennyson, I don't mean for this to be a lecture, you're gonna be looking at these poems, but I really want to give you a sense of how contrary to a kind of received view of Tennyson, that Queen Victoria loved him and her husband Prince Albert loved him, so he must be the acceptable, the poet acceptable to authorities, the poet who is producing this this idea of poetry as what belongs to the greatness of English culture as embodied in the king and her prince consort, Queen Victoria and Prince Albert. Everyone know about Victoria and Albert? Is this a, now you know how many bullets it takes to fill the Albert Hall? What's that a reference to? Sergeant Pepper, I read the news today, oh boy, now. Oh well. Victoria was queen. She married someone named Albert, who was her consort. He was not king because she was the ruler. And he died fairly young. She was the longest serving queen through 1901 until Queen Elizabeth served longer, was in office longer than she was. But she mourned all her life for the death of Albert, who, as I say, died young. Probably didn't prevent her from interesting sexual escapades later on, although no one is quite sure. But she's also associated with Victorian repression. So you might think, Tennyson, loved by Albert, who was essentially the person who made Tennyson's name. Tennyson, as I say, got these bad reviews and he stopped publishing. He said, forget it. But Albert really liked his poetry. Then when Albert died, Victoria found his poetry of grief and mourning, really helpful to her in coping with the death of Albert. That gives Tennyson a rep for being kind of the great bourgeois period of Britain and the great bourgeois poet of that period. And what you don't get then is his sheer and utter weirdness, and that's the important thing to get about him. So that's why I'm going on about this. I don't think we really have time to go through Simeon Stylites, but what I wanted to show you, so it's in one of the sheets that went around, is the sheet that doesn't have a fourth page. So on the top left, this is from Gibbon. So do people know who Edward Gibbon is? Ring any kind of bell?
Sounds familiar, but I can't remember it here.
Okay, so he was one of the great figures of the Enlightenment, which is to say the burgeoning of rationality and reason over religion in Western Europe. And the great figures of the Enlightenment include Kant, for example, the French Encyclopedia, Diderot, Rousseau, Voltaire, who Gibbon knew, you know what Voltaire said on his deathbed? He was a famous atheist. And on his deathbed, a priest came to him and said, "You're about to die. Don't you want to renounce the devil here on your deathbed? I think it would be a good idea." And Voltaire said, "Now is not the time to be making new enemies." So, no, he did not renounce the devil. And the Enlightenment was basically the beginning of modern secularism. And Gibbon was one of the great Enlightenment figures, and he wrote a massive book in 6 volumes called The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. If you know Evelyn Waugh's book, Decline and Fall, it's a reference to that title. And to put Gibbon in a nutshell, what caused the Roman Empire, which was better than any alternative, what caused its decline and fall was Christianity. So this is an anti-Christian book. And it is full of pretty hilarious remarks about Christianity. He can't officially be anti-Christian, or he won't be officially anti-Christian. It's part of his relentless irony that he won't be officially anti-Christian, but one of the things he talks about are heresies, and a heresy about the relationship of the Father to the Son and the Trinity, and they either have the same substance or they are the same person, and the two words are, what are they, homoethion and homothuon? That might not quite be right, but it's something like that. Difference in spelling, one has an E in it and one doesn't. And people were burnt at the stake, as Gibbon said, for a diphthong, for whether the middle vowel was a diphthong or not. He also has this great paragraph, how can one explain, so he's talking about the moment of the crucifixion when, according to the Bible, there was a 3 hours of darkness right after the crucifixion, and he says, how can one explain or how can one excuse the supine inattentiveness of all the great Roman writers, none of whom, despite the fact that they were looking at the skeletons of little fish, none of whom mentioned this this eclipse that went on for 3 hours over the entire earth. So that phrase, their supine inattentiveness. And the point is, no, they weren't inattentive. What the Bible said happened didn't. So that's kind of typical of Gibbon. So here in chapter 37, which is way deep into the history, he is talking, again, part of his history of Christianity, is he is talking about various ascetics, and he gets to Simeon, Stylites, and this is what Tennyson read. So he writes, among these heroes of the monastic life, and he's writing about lots of people who are mortifying the flesh, as it's called, who are living really difficult lives, the way Simone Weil would in the 20th century, out of some devotion to God. And here's his section on Simeon. Among these heroes of the monastic life, the name and genius of Simeon Stylites have been immortalized by the singular invention of an aerial penance. So the aerial penance, what is that? Do you remember, Quinn?
Penance.
Yeah, what is it that Simeon is doing? Where is he throughout the whole of the poem, or anyone?
He was up on a pillar, essentially.
Yeah.
Yeah, just by himself.
Yeah, so he lived on top of a pillar in the desert for 30 years, never coming down. Just on a little platform on top of this pillar. So food would be brought up to him, but he would never come down. And this was his way of punishing himself for the sin of being a human being. And that's what Tennyson is describing in that what's called a dramatic monologue. So he had read this in Gibbon, and this is what gave him the idea. Among these heroes, which is not a word that Gibbon is using approvingly, among these heroes of the monastic life, the name and genius of Simeon Stylites have been immortalized by the singular invention of an aerial penance. That is, so you are repentant way up in the air, an aerial penance. That's a typical Gibbon phrase. Just relish it. It's not like, oh yeah, 18th century, they knew what that meant, an aerial penance, of course. No, that's a bizarre phrase, an aerial penance. Yeah, okay, good. So, at the age of 13, the young Syrian deserted the profession of a shepherd and threw himself into an austere monastery. After a long and painful novitiate in which Simeon was repeatedly saved from pious suicide. Again, that should be a phrase, that's only a phrase Gibbon would write, pious suicide. He hated himself so much that he almost committed suicide out of piety, which is, according to Christianity, the worst thing you can do. It's the one unpardonable sin. It's literally unpardonable because you can't repent suicide. So, Gibbon is essentially saying, yeah, he was really depressed. So he was repeatedly saved from pious suicide. He established his residence on a mountain about 30, 40 miles to the east of Antioch within the space of a mantra or circle of stones to which he had himself, to which he had attached himself by a ponderous chain. He ascended a column which was successfully raised from the height of 9 to that of 60 feet from the ground. So that's something that he talks about in the poem. In this last and lofty station, the Syrian anachoret, which we would now call an anchorite. Have you heard that term? So an anchorite, it doesn't have to do with an anchor, although anchors became their emblem, but it's from a Greek word meaning someone who withdraws. So the Syrian anachoret resisted the heat of 30 summers and the cold of as many winters. Habit and exercise instructed him to maintain his dangerous situation without fear or giddiness and successfully to assume the different postures of devotion. He sometimes prayed in an erect attitude with his outstretched arms in the figure of a cross, but his most familiar practice was that of bending his meager skeleton from the forehead to the feet. And a curious spectator, after numbering 1,244 repetitions, at length desisted from the endless account. So someone went to see him and saw him bend down 1,244 times and stopped counting at that point, like in a single day. The progress of an ulcer in his thigh might shorten, but it could not disturb this celestial life. And he's italicizing celestial to tell you it's a little bit of a joke. That is, it's literally celestial because he's in the sky, which is what celestial means. But it's not going to get him saved. And the patient hermit expired without descending from his column. A prince, so if anyone else did this, a prince who should capriciously inflict such tortures would be deemed a tyrant, but it would surpass the power of a tyrant to impose a long and miserable existence on the reluctant victims of his cruelty. So a tyrant might do this kind of thing to someone, but the tyrant could not prevent such a person from dying if they wanted to die. This is a fate worse than death, is what Gibbon is saying. So who then is he suggesting the tyrant is that would do something that a human tyrant can never do?
God,
or the church, or the Pope, or the authority, the Christianity. So Christianity does worse things to people, Gibbon is saying, as Simeon indicates, does worse things to people than the worst tyrant could do. This voluntary martyrdom must have gradually destroyed the sensibility both of the mind and body, nor can it be presumed that fanatics who torment themselves are susceptible of any lively affection for the rest of mankind. So you're supposed to love your neighbor. Hard to believe that Simeon loved anyone, especially towards the end of things. A cruel unfeeling temper as distinguished the monks of every age and country, their stern indifference, which is seldom mollified by personal friendship, is inflamed by religious hatred, and their merciless zeal has strenuously administered the holy office of the Inquisition. So this is how you get the Inquisition. Just the next line. He has lots of examples of this. The monastic saints, who excite only the contempt and pity of a philosopher, namely me, Gibbon, were respected and almost adored by the prince and people. So that's how he got to be a legendary figure, because of the horrible torture he inflicted upon himself. So that's where Tennyson got the idea of writing this poem. So you shouldn't see it. This is just a way of contextualizing for you as a poem in which Tennyson is writing what's called a dramatic monologue. So what would that mean?
Almost like something you perform on a stage.
Yeah. And what would it mean about the relation of the poet to the poem? Yeah.
The poet's the speaker in the poem.
The poet. Sorry, just
so
saying.
I know the poet isn't the speaker in the poem.
Yeah, very much. The poet is not the speaker of the poem. That here you have a poem in which a dramatic character who's named in the title is speaking as though Shakespeare were writing a soliloquy. And you shouldn't think that when Iago says, "Oh, I'm so glad I'm going to be killing Othello," that Shakespeare is saying, "Oh, I'm so glad I'm going to be killing Othello." On the other hand, or I'm going to drive him into the madness of jealousy. I'm so glad I'm going to do that. That's not Shakespeare. But on the other hand, it's a little Shakespeare. Because for Shakespeare, that's what makes the play work. So he can get into the idea that, yeah, this is what he wants to be saying in this soliloquy, because it's going to yield the effects that he wants to yield. So when you write, you know, something you get taught in high school is don't confuse the speaker of the poet, the speaker with the poet. Poems have speakers, and sometimes the speaker is like the poet and sometimes not. And what I generally do when I teach poetry, but I'm going to do it less in this class, is say, no, the default is the speaker is the poet, or at least what the poet thinks she is, who the poet imagines herself to be. But when you're writing dramatic poetry, and a dramatic monologue is a dramatic poem, then you can't confuse the speaker with the poet. If you have, you know, a famous thing is Shakespeare said, neither a borrower nor a lender be. But no, it's Polonius who is not the sharpest knife in the drawer who says that, not Shakespeare. So if you see that, you know, on a poster, neither a borrower nor a lender be, Shakespeare, it's not so clear how good that advice is, or at least that Shakespeare meant it as advice, partly because he himself was a borrower and a lender, and he did well as a borrower and a lender. So, to thine own self be true, and it must follow as the night the day, that thou canst not then be false to any other man. Shakespeare. Well, no, Polonius, not Shakespeare. On the other hand, there is some level at which Shakespeare is doing a kind of method acting in which he understands what it would mean to mean that. And that's what Tennyson and the other great writer of dramatic monologues we're going to be reading in this course is Browning. That's what they are doing. Do people know the poem My Last Duchess? Do you remember the first line? It's anyone? So it begins, "That's my last duchess painted on the wall, looking as though she were alive." So, yeah, Browning was never married to a duchess, and he didn't have a painting of her on the wall, and she didn't look as though she were alive. He actually gives a speech prefix, Ferrara. It's the Duke of Ferrara who is saying that. Browning wrote, and right now I think you're going to be happy that we're not doing it, but at some point you'll be sad that we didn't. He wrote one of the longest epics in English, longer than Paradise Lost, longer than The Prelude, longer than The Excursion, called The Ring and the Book. which is all made of dramatic monologues. The first and last chapters are Browning pretty much speaking in his own voice, but after that it's all these people. It's about a murderer. It's about the husband of a rich woman who murders her. It's about the accusation against him. It's his defense. It's various lawyers speaking. She is mortally wounded, but not so wounded that she can't have an 800-line intervention. And eventually the Pope, it's based on a true story, eventually the Pope intervenes, and it's actually really great, but it's all made up of dramatic monologues. So it is actually an inspiration to Kurosawa's Rashomon. That is, you're getting the story of the murder from a bunch of different witnesses, all of whom are reciting dramatic monologues. So the idea of the dramatic monologue is that as a poet, you need to think about the character, which is to say, enter into the character's point of view, at least to some extent. Browning would do it, had a lot of fun doing that. Tennyson, less so. It wasn't fun. It was, here is someone who is whose attitude towards the world is one of bafflement. How is it that we live in a world which is so terrible, which is what you get in Simeon Stylites. The Stylite is a pillar. So he is Simeon on his pillar. How can you be, what can get you to be so messed up as he is? So messed up that the experience of torture that he's feeling as being a living human being, the experience of guilt that he's feeling as being a living human being, is just overwhelmingly horrible. What kind of world is this that someone born would have that experience? And Tennyson is asking that for real, because in a sense that's his experience. If you think of Simeon, just going back to what Benjamin Jowett said, if you think of Simeon as really an extreme figure of a human being, he's extreme, maybe not in the same direction as Tennyson, but not 180 degrees in the opposite direction. And again, the point is that Tennyson was really extreme. He had these extreme experiences and was tormented all his life by extreme grief over the death of Hallam. And so he starts writing these amazing poems right after Hallam dies. Another one, and the one we should look at that we have more we have some time for, is the poem called Ulysses. And did you Google that, Quinn? Ulysses? It's okay.
By Tennyson or
yeah.
by... Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You did?
No, I didn't Google Ulysses.
Okay.
But I've Googled Ulysses by James Joyce.
By James Joyce. Yeah, Joyce didn't like Tennyson, but Joyce misapprehended him, or misunderestimated him, to quote President Bush II. Joyce called him Alfred Lawn Tennyson. So that's a Joycean joke, like lawn tennis, not Alfred Lord Tennyson, but Alfred Lawn Tennyson. Okay. And he parodied Tennyson as a poem called Maud, which begins, "Come into the garden, Maud." And Joyce parodied that as, "Come into the outhouse, Maud." So Joyce thought of himself as turning against everything Tennyson stood for. But in fact, what Joyce didn't get, and Joyce got everything except a few things, was that Tennyson was pretty much as radical as he was. But Joyce took the received version of Tennyson. Hero, as I say, to Queen Victoria, which meant no hero to an Irish writer in the late 19th, early 20th century. The opposite of a hero to an Irish writer. But Joyce writes this novel, Ulysses, which never once mentions Odysseus, the Greek name of Ulysses. It mentions everything except Odysseus. It mentions Ulysses Grant. So there are lots of Ulysseses, or there's some Ulysseses in Ulysses, but not Odysseus. But the Tennyson poem, like Joyce's novel, is based on, well, I've already told you, but whom? What great ancient poet?
Homer.
Homer.
Yeah.
Yes. Who recited an epic called the Odyssey. The Latin name for Odysseus is Ulysses. It's actually thought, just again a little point of information, that Ulysses is the older name, that Odysseus was a Greek transformation of the original phonetic sound of the name, that the L turns into a D. The Lotus Eaters, as we already saw, comes out of the Odyssey. And what Odysseus does is he goes home after the Trojan War. It takes him a little while. Takes him 10 years. And that is essentially what Tennyson knows when he writes this. Again, he's 23 when he's writing this. Hallam has just died. But he also knows Dante's version of Ulysses from the Inferno. And Dante hadn't read Homer. Most people in Dante's day could not read Greek. Very few could, like a vanishingly small percentage. Latin was the classical language that educated people knew. Dante very famously stopped writing in Latin and started writing in a modern language. And he said, we have stopped writing in ancient languages. It's time to, after all, it's the 14th century, for God's sake. And so Dante is writing in Italian, and he's writing essays about why you should write in modern languages. But Dante's hero as a poet was Virgil. And Virgil obviously wrote in Latin. He is Dante's hero. And in the Divine Comedy, just to tell you very briefly, Dante finds himself in a dark wood. He doesn't know how he got here, but he finds himself in a dark wood, and he freaks out. He just doesn't know what to do. And then Virgil shows up and says, let me show you around. And what he shows him around, almost literally, because they're circling and circling the drain, which is the center of the earth, is hell, the inferno. Inferno, anyone know what it literally means? We think of it as a giant fire, but we only think of it as a giant fire because of Dante, because it's hell. But Dante's hell doesn't burn. So anyone know what it means literally, etymologically? It means what is below us. So if you, infrared is the wavelength on the spectrum which is below red. Infra means beneath or below in Latin. The inferno is the place below the ground. And the center of the earth is the center of hell in Dante. That's where Satan is. Virgil shows Dante, who doesn't name himself until the Purgatorio. He's just the speaker. But in the middle of the Purgatorio, we find out that speaker is actually Dante. Virgil gives him a tour of hell, and then a tour of most of Purgatory. But Virgil says, I can't go any further because I wasn't saved. And Dante said, Dante reveres him, but Virgil is not saved. He's not suffering in hell, except for the fact that he is excluded from salvation, and that itself is a cause of suffering. But he's not being tortured. He's not put head down in barrels of shit the way some people are in the Inferno. He's not having himself being cannibalized by other people, which happens to other people in the Inferno. It's not a pleasant place, especially when you get down near the center of the Earth. One of the things that Virgil takes him to see is Ulysses, who is deep, deep, deep down in hell in Dante. And the reason he's so deep down is that he belongs to the worst kind of sinner that you can be in Dante, which is someone who commits violence dishonestly. So just to give you a very quick account of that, the best kind of sin, the sin that you get least punished for, are sins of lust. You had the hots for someone, you were married, they were married, but you got together anyhow. No good, thou shalt not commit adultery, Ten Commandments, that's really not good. But it's also somewhat victimless, especially if the person you've cheated on is a vicious murderer who's going to be found way down much more deeply in the Inferno. So you have sins of incontinence, as they're called, sins where you can't stop yourself from taking a pleasure that you shouldn't be taking. So gluttony is a sin of incontinence as well. Next, the second of the three basic levels of the Inferno are sins of violence. So murderers are at the lowest level. Below that are sins of betrayal. That is violence where the person you are committing violence against thinks you're their friend. So that's even worse. It's one thing to hurt someone who knows you're trying to hurt them, and they at least can put up a fight. It's another thing to gain someone's trust in order to hurt them. And those are the worst sins for Dante. And Ulysses belongs to that level of hell. So on the same sheet as Gibbon, on the next line, This is the contemporaneous translation from the contemporaneous translation of Canto 26 of the Inferno. This is H.F. Carey's translation, which had come out fairly recently. Dante was only translated into English in the 19th century for the first time. So this is what Tennyson would have read. He could also read the Italian, but this is the standard English translation. And this is Dante speaking. Upon the bridge, I forward bent to look and grasped a flinty mass, or else had fallen, though pushed not from the height. The guide, that is Virgil, who marked how I did gaze attentive, thus began. Within these ardors are the spirits each swathed in confining fire. So ardors there means heats. Master, thy word, I answered, hath assured me, yet I deemed already of the truth. I already figured that's who they were, that there were spirits there. Already wished to ask thee, who is in yon fire that comes so parted at the summit, as it seemed ascending from that funeral pile where lay the Theban brothers? So there's a fire that seems to be coming to talk to him. Virgil replies, within, Ulysses there and Diomed endure their penal tortures, thus to vengeance now together hasting as erewhile to wrath. So Diomedes and Ulysses killed sleeping Trojan soldiers. So they snuck in and they killed them asleep, which is really not a nice thing to do. Think of Macbeth. These in the flame with ceaseless groans deplore the ambush of the horse. So what horse would that be?
Trojan.
Yes, which was also Odysseus' idea. And this is in the Aeneid. that opened wide a portal for that goodly seed to pass, which sowed imperial Rome. So what happens is the Trojans escape the burning of Troy, and they found Rome. That's what the Aeneid is about, Virgil's great poem. Nor less the guile lament they, whence of her Achilles reft, Deidamia yet in death complains. So this is referring to the beginning of the Iliad. This is the wrath of Achilles. And there is rude the stratagem that Troy of her Palladium spoiled. And then Dante says, if they have power of utterance from within these sparks, said I, O master, think my prayer a thousandfold in repetition urged, and thou vouchsafe to pause till here the horned flames arrive. See how toward it with desire I bend. So Dante speaks to all the damned. He has conversations with them, and here he wants to talk to Ulysses. He thus, this is Virgil, thy prayer is worthy of much praise, and I accept it therefore. But do thou thy tongue refrain, to question them be mine, for I divine thy wish, and they perchance, for they were Greeks, might shun discourse with thee. The Greeks don't like the Italians. When there the flame had come, where time and place seemed fitting to my guide, he thus began, O ye, this is to Odysseus and Diomedes, O ye who dwell two spirits in one fire, if living I of you did merit aught, whate'er the measure were of that desert, when in the world my lofty strain I poured, move ye not on, till one of you unfold in what clime death o'ertook him, self-destroyed. So, you two tell the story. Of the old flame, forthwith, the greater horn began to roll, murmuring as a fire that labors with the wind, then to and fro, wagging the top as a tongue uttering sounds throughout its voice and spake. So the fire is speaking. When I escaped from Circe, so who is this speaking? Who escaped from Circe? Odysseus. So this is the story that Dante thinks he knows. It's not from the Odyssey, which he hadn't read. But there are other stories about Odysseus. When I escaped from Circe, who beyond a circling year had held me near Caieta by her charms, ere thus Aeneas yet had named the shore, nor fondness for my son, nor reverence of my old father, nor return of love that should have crowned Penelope with joy, could overcome in me the zeal I had to explore the world and search the ways of life, man's evil and his virtue. So Dante doesn't know the story of the Odyssey, in the Odyssey, where Odysseus returns back to Ithaca. In this version of the story, Dante is saying he doesn't return to Ithaca. So Tennyson knew that he did, and he's going to combine the Odyssey story with Dante's story, but here is the Dante version. Forth I sailed into the deep, illimitable main with but one bark and the small faithful band that yet cleave to me. As Iberia far... So what's Iberia? Iberian Peninsula?
Portugal
and Spain. So he got all the way to the peninsula. It's Iberia far. Far as Morocco, either shore I saw, and the Sardinian and each isle beside which round that ocean bathes. Tardy with age were I and my companions when we came to the straight pass where Hercules ordained the boundaries not to be o'erstepped by man. So anyone know what he's referring to there? They got to the place where Hercules had put a boundary that humans should not go beyond.
I was going to say the Styx, but that's not right.
No, it's actually a place in the Mediterranean. It's called the Pillars of Hercules, and it's at Gibraltar. So there are two large rocks, and the mythology was, this is as far as you're allowed to sail. Do not go out into the Atlantic, because you'll be lost. So that was ancient mythology. So we got to that straight pass where Hercules ordained the boundaries not to be overstepped by man. The walls of Sevilla to my right, I left. On the other hand, already Ceuta passed. And then he speaks. Oh, brothers, I began, who to the west, through perils without number, now have reached to this, the short remaining watch that yet our senses have to wake. Refuse not proof of the unpeopled world following the track of Phoebus. Phoebus is who? Mythologically, god of
the sun.
The sun. So we're following the track of Phoebus to the west. Very famous line from Dante, which Carey translates as, this the short remaining watch that yet our senses have to wake. In a literal translation of the Italian, and this is what obsessed Tennyson, was the short vigil of the senses. So in life, you experience the world for a short time. That's his definition of life. That is Ulysses' definition before he dies. This short vigil of the senses. An amazing phrase, and one that obsesses a lot of people and obsessed Tennyson, the short vigil of the senses. So call to mind, Ulysses keeps addressing his sailors, call to mind from whence we sprang. Ye were not formed to live the life of brutes, but virtue to pursue and knowledge high. With these few words, I sharpened for the voyage the mind of my associates, that I then could scarcely have withheld them. To the dawn, our poop we turned, and for the witless flight made our oars wing, still gaining on the left, each star of the other pole night now beheld, and our so low that from the ocean floor it rose not. So what Dante is describing here is how they go out into the Atlantic and head south, and they start seeing the southern constellations of the southern sky. Dante had no idea what those constellations looked like. No one he knew did. This was, he's sending Ulysses on a sea voyage that no one in Italy had ever taken. But they're seeing the southern sky, and Dante's making it up. He's imagining it. So, five times re-illumed, as oft vanished the light from underneath the moon, since the deep way we entered, when from far appeared a mountain dim, loftiest methought of all I e'er beheld. So they're going south and they see this gigantic mountain. Again, Dante is making this up, the way Poe makes up Antarctica in the narrative of Arthur Gordon Pym. It's a pure fantasy, so he can do whatever he wants. And they see this gigantic mountain. We're going to find out, seven cantos later, that that's Purgatory, the mountain of Purgatory. But he doesn't know that. They see this gigantic mountain in the south. Joy seized us straight, but soon to mourning changed. From the new land a whirlwind sprung, and at her foremost side did strike the vessel. Thrice it whirled her round with all the waves. The fourth time lifted up the poop and sank the prow. So fate decreed, and over us the booming billow closed. So that's the story of Ulysses as he tells it to Dante in the Inferno. And that's what's in the back of Tennyson's mind. So let's go to Ulysses and just again, keep in mind the short vigil of the senses. That is, Helen is dead, and in a sense, Helen is here, Ulysses, in Tennyson's poem. But Tennyson is combining both the Odyssey and Dante. So he's giving a version of Dante's Ulysses, but with the background of Homer. Okay, so let's start reading it. Can someone read, let's say, to line 21?
Okay.
We can just go around the room and volunteer.
Yes, Julia, go.
So all the way to 21?
Yeah, this is page 10 of the anthology, of the Oxford Anthology.
And little prophets, but an idle king, by this still hearth among these barren crags, matched with an aged wife, I meet and dole unequal laws unto a savage race, that hoard and sleep and feed and know not me. I cannot rest from travel. I will drink life to the lees. All times I have enjoyed greatly, have suffered greatly, both with those that love me and alone. On shore and when through scudding drifts the rainy Hyades, vexed the dim sea, I am become a name. For always roaming with a hungry heart, much have I seen and known. Cities of men and manners, climates, councils, governments, myself not least, but honored of them all, and drunk delight of battle with my peers, far on the ringing plains of windy Troy. I am a part of all that I have met, yet all experience is an arch wherethrough gleams that untraveled world whose margin fades forever and forever when I move.
Great, thank you. Okay, so what do people make of, so just very quick plot summary. Yeah. Now I'm king of Ithaca, I'm running things, I'm home, but so what? But I cannot rest from travel, so he's going to make this trip, which is what Dante's Ulysses says to his man. Let's just keep going. Let's keep traveling. They all say yes. So here he's reflecting on himself. This is a dramatic monologue. And I'm become a name. He's no longer anything but a symbol of himself. He's famous, but so what? And that's not what he wants. Famous line, I am a part of all that I have met. And then what do you make of lines 19 through 21? Yet all experience is an arch where through gleams that untraveled world whose margin fades forever and forever when I move. So try to paraphrase that. Yeah.
He's creating an image where there is like an arch, so picture you're like on a boat trying to go under this bridge, but the finish line just keeps on pushing back and back, so the more he explores, the more there is to see, and it'll never be done.
Okay, good. And all experience is a frame. So arch there also means frame. He's thinking a bit of the Pillars of Hercules here, which are not an arch, but it's still the same, but it enables the metaphor. And anything you experience is only a frame for, as you say, what's always receding, for what's not been experienced. So anything that you manage to experience is a disappointment, because now it's been there, done that. So there's this desire to know what can't be known, to see what can't be seen. Pace, John Lennon. Yet all experience is an arch where through gleams that untraveled world, that otherness, gleams that untraveled world whose margin fades forever and forever when I move. Okay, someone read to 132. Let's just go around the room. So, Sophia?
I don't have
a physical copy of the book. Okay, can you, Julia, can you lend it to her for a sec? So line 22 to 32.
How dull is it to pause, to make amends, to rest unburnished, not to shine in use, as though to breathe were life, like child on life, were all too little, and of one to me little remains, but every hour is saved from that eternal silence, something more. A bringer of new things, and vile it were, for some three suns to store and pour myself, and this gray spirit, yearning and desire to follow knowledge like a sinking star beyond the utmost bound of human thought.
Thank you. Yeah, so quick paraphrase, someone. Yeah.
But to like pause and settle with the travels you have is more boring than if you were to keep exploring.
Yeah. It's so I can live 3 more years here, roughly speaking. For some 3 sons to store and hoard myself. While my spirit would yearn and desire to follow knowledge like a sinking star. So remember the sinking star in Dante? As they go south, the northern constellations are sinking. But he's still following what he can never reach. But it's desire, it's yearning in desire. That's what he is experiencing, is the desire for what is always beyond reach. As though to breathe were life, really? If I just stay here and breathe for 3 years, that's not life. Can you read through line 44?
Sure. 32 to 44?
Yeah. I should tell you that this book is on reserve. So if you need to Xerox it, you shouldn't be using electronic devices here without accommodation, but if you need to Xerox it, just go to the library until you get your copies.
Beyond the utmost bound of human tonight, this is my son, mine own Telemachus, to whom I leave the scepter and the isle, well-loved of me, discerning to fulfill this labor, by slow prudence to make mild a rugged people, and through soft degrees subdue them to the useful and the good. Most blameless is he, centered in the sphere of common duties, descent not to fail in offices of tenderness and pay, meet adoration to my household gods. When I am gone, he works his work, I mine.
Yeah, so Telemachus, Odysseus' son, here he is. He'll be a good king of Ithaca. It's all good. He can do it. He's a prudent guy. He'll do well. Kind of like Charles III. He'll know what he's doing. I am totally uninterested in this. He works his work, I mine. My work is not to be breeding in Ithaca, being an idle king here in Ithaca. My work is to continue going through that arch of experience to see that remoter world. Quinn, can you do, I guess, through line 53?
The bookstore was out of copies.
Yeah. And the online store was empty too.
Out. And on Amazon, can't get them till February.
And no, Barnes & Noble has it within 100-mile radius.
Yeah.
Okay, what I'm going to try to do is I'll scan the reading for Wednesday, and I'll keep doing that, but you should print it out instead of doing it on your phones or computers or whatever. Okay, go for it. So you didn't get to do the reading at all for today?
If you went to the library.
Okay.
If you looked on the Amazon look inside for the
Oh, God. All right. I'll do some scanning for a while.
I'm doing a financial hooks for fast shipping to get this in time, actually.
All right. What he did.
There lies the port, the vessel puffs her sail, there gloom the dark broad seas, my mariners' souls that have toiled and wrought and fought with me, that ever with a frolic welcome took the thunder and the sunshine, and opposed free hearts, free foreheads, you and I are old. Old age hath yet his honor and his toil, death closes all, but some ere the end. Some work of noble note may yet be done, not unbecoming men that strove with gods.
Great. So remember, he's 24 when he writes this. Don't think this is an old man saying, yeah, it's okay to be old. He's 24, but this is full of despair. But he's saying, yeah, let's keep going. And this is about the death of Helon. So just keep that in mind. Okay, we'll read through 161. So the lights begin to twinkle from the rocks.
The lights begin to twinkle from the rocks. The long day wanes. The slow moon climbs. The deep moans round with many voices. Come, my friends.
'Tis not too late to seek a newer world. Push off, and sitting well, in order smite the sounding furrows, for my purpose holds to sail beyond the sunset and the baths of all the western stars until I die.
Yeah, so sailing beyond the sunset, that's like going through that, to that gleam. And we're almost done, Rina?
Yeah. Of all the what, oh sorry. It may be that the gulfs will wash us down. It may be we shall touch the happy isles and see the great Achilles whom we knew. Though much is taken, much abides, and though we are not now the strength in which old days moved earth and heaven, that which we are, one equal temper of heroic hearts, made weak by time and fate, but strong in will, to strive, to seek, to find, and not to yield.
Okay, so famous last line, it seems like, yes, we're so good, we're going to strive and seek and find, not yield. But the irony here is he's about to die and go to hell. And that is the background that Tennyson has for this poem. But Ulysses is still sailing because he wants to see the great Achilles, whom we knew. So, yeah, we knew him in the Iliad. Now, maybe we can touch the happy isles and see the great Achilles, whom we knew. Who would Achilles be? For Tennyson. The dead person that he wants
Arthur
to see again.
Yeah.
Sorry?
It would be his friend Arthur.
Yeah, it would be Helen again. And he knows that they won't. That the irony of this poem is, no, that's not where they're going to end up. But there's still this idea that, yes, astronomy and geology, they crush us all. But there's this gleam of desire. And the experience is the experience of desire, not of the satisfaction of desire. That is the one thing in Tennyson that you can hope and try to experience is hope. It's, you can hope to experience hope, even though hope will never be met. You will never get what you hope, but you can hope to experience hope. And that's part of the weirdness of Tennyson. And it's what Simeon is feeling also. It's like, I'm on top of this pillar and I think I'm going to be saved. And things are just getting worse and worse and worse. It's all a nightmare of horror. But there is still this gesture, this tendency towards the experience of hope. The hope for an experience like one you've never had. Okay, see you all on Wednesday. I will scan the reading for that. Do people want me to scan the whole thing, the whole first 52 pages or whatever it is? Okay, I will do that. That way you can catch up. Okay, see you all Wednesday.